Michael, really, really serious question here. Are you ready?
All right, I'm ready, Gio. Let's see what you got.
Okay. Cards or board games? What is your preference? And depending on which one you pick, like which specific game do you think is your favorite? Or like one of your top
Oh,
ones?
okay, that's actually a really good question. Okay. There are pros and cons to both, I will say.
Gotcha.
With cards, you can just pack a pack of cards in your pocket and you can carry them around, and it's so easy. And there's also a huge variety of games that you can
Right.
play with cards. You can, poker, war, go fish, or whatever.
Yeah.
We played other games. We learned a bunch, actually.
Yeah, like, 'cause I was never raised with cards. I was more of a board game kid. So I mean, they're fun to learn, but like, it's a lot.
Yeah, but then with board games, I don't know. Like, we can.
Like for
There's more
me,
set rules, I guess.
yeah, like with like cards are very convenient, I think, 'cause there's a lot you can do with them, and there's games for everyone, but like for example, I really love chess. And like that to me, that like no card game will ever beat like a good a solid match in
You're pretty
chess.
good at chess. I remember we play. You beat me. I remember
Yeah, I mean
that.
I'm not like an expert by me, but I really enjoy the game. Or like Settlers of Catan. As a nerd, I feel like
Oh,
as
I'm pretty.
nerds, I feel
I
like
love Catan.
we
That's
have
a
to
good
bring that
one.
one
Catan's
up.
a good game. I always lose whenever I play, but
Well,
it's.
yeah, and like for me too. Back in high school, we had a friend group that would play, and there was always like the half of us that just played because we thought it was fun, and then the other half that was like, our friendship's going to end if we don't win, if like, we don't win this game.
So, are you more of a board game kind of person?
I would say so.
I would say honestly, I'm probably not a card person, honestly. I love board games, but if I had to choose, you're making me choose here,
Okay.
I would choose cards.
Okay, but here's a real question though. Do you like the more classic card games or like Uno or something?
I play Uno.
You
Uno's a good
play,
one.
yeah,
I
I
count
because
Uno.
like card like Uno is fantastic, and I don't have anything against cards, but it's there are times where you're just like it's very sometimes very difficult to keep up
No,
with.
I understand that. I remember when I was back in Boy Scouts at our campouts, you'd always have like this game called MAU. I don't know if
Oh,
you've heard of
I
it.
yeah we play I think we played it at one point, and it was like,
At UD we played? Oh,
yeah,
I don't think I was there for
well,
that.
because they didn't it, that's the one where they you don't you have to learn the rules
Yeah,
yourself,
as you
right?
go. Yeah,
Yeah.
because you can't tell the rules like before you play. Like as you play, you have to pick up the rules, and if every time you break a rule, you get penalized.
Right.
That yeah, I remember like it was really hard like the first few times playing, but like once you pick it up, it's a pretty fun game.
Yeah, I mean it takes and that's a game too, I think, where you'd have to play it pretty consistently, not like play in a burst and then not touch it for a few
Yeah,
years and then come
I
back.
kind of forgot the rules. Isn't it a long time? But
Yeah,
okay, what about Egyptian War or Slapjack?
I don't know.
Oh
Like it
man.
can be like it. That's one of those games where I have to really be in the mood to play.
Yeah,
Otherwise, I'm
yeah.
like, can we just do go fish or
Yeah, honestly,
something?
yeah, me too. Like if I'm too tired, I hate Slapjack. But when I remember when I played a lot back a few years ago, I was
Yeah,
pretty good.
you were
I
pretty
was I
good.
was pretty good. I was pretty good at that game.
The most, I think, the most. The time I was probably the most pro at a card game was when it was eighth grade retreat and we were playing poker, but we were gambling with these rocks that we found in like the flower bed outside the retreat center. And it was like we were all very serious about it. Like we all knew what we were doing, but then you just see like, oh, we're not even betting real money. It's just these like dirty rocks that we found on the ground
Well,
somewhere.
playing poker is pretty common. I remember from like up at UD. Like it's a pretty common game. Did you
Yeah.
ever play with the guys up there?
I think a few, like, so I actually remember, I think it was either the first or second day we were there, there was a big board game. Not board game, sorry. Big poker game in Teresa. That's actually where I met quite a few people. And we weren't betting any money, but it was like I played for a little, and then people would come in. So they'd have like a newcomer be partnered with someone who was playing. So like I, taught someone to play. I forget who it was, but. Like I teach them to play, and then we sort of would just rotate. So,
Okay. Are you good at poker? Do you have a good poker face?
It's all right. All right. I wouldn't. I don't. If I were to play like an actual competition, I probably would be very reserved with the amount of money I get. We'll just go with that.
I remember I was watching the Simpsons episode the other day, and Homer was playing poker. Okay. I like the Simpsons. They're pretty.
No,
funny.
They're them and like that. The Simpsons Family
Guy. I'm not a big Family Guy.
You're not. No.
Simpsons is more like my style. Okay. I mean, they're both. It's just stupid.
Yeah, like it's.
But
stupid.
Family Guy can be pretty. Can be much.
There are times where it's you definitely have to you know prepare yourself. But they were playing poker
and like Homer gets like a really like a straight flush, but he has no idea and he accidentally wins. And it's like that's me playing poker, honestly.
You're like, oh, I won. Like how did? Yeah, like, exactly. Why am I getting all the chips?
Yeah, exactly. All right, so speaking of
long,
complicated games.
And irresponsibly betting your
inheritance away.
Yeah, inheritance and student tuition.
Quadragesimo Anno.
the finale of Quadragesimo Anno is finally here. You know, not only did we finally get to reviewing this encyclical, but we did it consistently.
Uh-huh, and we finished.
And we were finished. So, and this is good, too, because next week I'm actually going to be on family vacation in Mexico. We won't be able to do an episode next week. When we do come back.
Oh, I'll be gone at that point.
Oh, well, we're going to figure that out.
Okay.
We have a contingency plan in place.
Oh, all right. Are you going to do solo episodes?
No, we're not going to do solo. I think we're going to try to do a, like, you know, those podcast episodes some people do where they're like in different locations,
like on Zoom or something.
Yeah, we'll do a test one and see, but that's why the next one we're gonna do a book review rather than an actual encyclical, just it's like as a test run, I guess. But
mm-hmm, definitely, yeah. So that'll be a good time.
Mm-hmm. And then also we forgot to address this
time,
but one of the so after our casual Saturday episode, the last one we did, you know, we mentioned some stuff about the SSPX, and
I said some things that were wrong, which I apologize for.
Wasn't necessarily wrong, well, probably wrong, more for clarification, but there was a listener on Instagram actually messaged me and said he really liked the episode, but he was he wanted to explain some stuff about the SSPX because there. So it turns out they actually do have bishops,
which
we were unaware of, but that there, you know, that there was some, that there was an excommunication at one point, but that it was eventually lifted.
I do honestly, I remember that. Benedict. I don't know why I forgot about that. Yeah, because the whole initial controversy was the fact that Lefebvre ordained some people to be bishops without the consent of the Holy See. Right. And then I forgot that Benedict the 16th actually lifted the excommunication. And I forgot there's actually like a few bishops still around.
Yeah, because one part of what he's what this individual said, he says that they, the SSPX, operate without a defined territory under the direction of their canonical superiors and bishops, but without any basis canonically, which is what makes them irregular, since they aren't operating in any way that is defined under the law. And it also says that the SSPX has constantly refused to regularize itself and reestablish full communion with the Catholic Church, which is why there's arguments about whether or not they are schismatic. Since that term has very specific canonical meaning as a way to answer this question, it seems to be resolvable with many clerics, you know, or I guess I should say it's difficult to determine whether or not they are actually in schism with the Catholic Church, which is what makes, you know, which makes attending them or not kind of a more difficult question to answer. But so first of all, we appreciate them reaching out and suggesting this, because we didn't know that. And it's I'm glad that people are listening, are willing to engage with us, because that shows that they want, you know, they want us to present good information. So, you know, if you ever, you know, hear something you think maybe we messed up on, or you have suggestions, you know, feel free to message us, whether it's, you know, on Instagram or by email or Twitter, because we will address it as best as we can.
Definitely.
Because we, you know, obviously we want to, these are some relatively controversial issues, both in a political and a religious sense.
We want to make sure we're giving accurate information out there. Yeah. Okay, so now that we dealt with that,
So just to, as a reiteration, the book that we are reviewing, not next week, but the week after, is a book called Dolphus, an Austrian Patriot, which is about the man who was the Chancellor of Austria in sort of in between World War One and World War Two, and who attempted to implement Pius XI's encyclical as sort of the governing principle behind the Austrian state.
And we'll introduce the book a little bit more, kind of like our own critiques of the book,
as well as
Dollfuss himself. Yeah, and the things he does well. It's by Johannes Messner, who I believe was a priest. The book we read has a foreword by Dr. Alice von Hildebrand, whose husband was a renowned philosopher, Heydrich von Hildebrand.
And one of the other authors as well is John Zimmerich, who he wrote The Politically Incorrect Guide to Catholicism, which is part of the Politically Incorrect Guide series of books, which was actually pretty good. Like, it's it shouldn't be your only source of information, but it's definitely a good primer, I think. So, but yeah, we'll introduce that book in the following episode, and we'll give our critiques, what we thought he did well and what we disagreed with. So on to Quadragesimo Anno. This is the last, it's from paragraphs 100 to about, 148 is kind of just the
benediction
kind of thing. So kind of 147, so the last, 40 to 50 paragraphs. So as with the last one, we sort of broke this down to three main parts, and that was kind of the good thing about these last 40 or so paragraphs, is that it was actually pretty easy to sort of pinpoint, like, when he transitions and what are his main areas of argument.
Yeah, I think it definitely starts off really strong, but I think around, like, paragraph 130, he kind of, I'm not going to, like, say, like, he starts rambling, but I think he definitely starts to address things he's already talked about. It definitely kind of loses its focus towards the end.
Yeah, I mean, it's still
important. It gets a bit complicated, because he starts introducing a lot of ideas at once. But, why don't we go ahead and get started? So he actually starts to critique kind of like the present economic system in place and other economic systems that are gaining popularity in the world. And so he focuses on three major economic systems. So capitalism, socialism, and communism.
Yeah, and those last two, that distinction is going to be very important, because that's an original concept that Pius XI introduces into this encyclical to sort of update Leo XIII's, because his definition of communism and socialism was just under the label socialism and was incredibly broad.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to, like, it's also very helpful to define terms, because people can throw out, like, socialists all the time. I remember there's a Trent Horn debate, right?
Yeah. And so I think we mentioned this in the first or second episode, but on the Reason and Theology YouTube channel, which is hosted by Michael Lofton, he at one point had a Catholic economics sort of roundtable debate where he had Trent Horn, who represented the capitalist position, debating another guy named Thomas Stork, who was a distributist, and then I'm pretty sure this is the correct person, I may be wrong, but his name was Jose Menes, who represented the sort of Catholic socialist position. I know he worked with the on the Josias website, but that was kind of a debate. And I think one of the issues with it was that the term socialist was not properly defined.
Yeah, exactly. Because Pius XI kind of, I'm not saying he defines, he has his own definition, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's pretty, I'd say for the most part it's accurate, but there definitely are some aspects of it that I think can still be
reconciled,
right, or just not as, that can still be, I think, misused or, you know, are not properly understood.
Okay, all right, definitely. So let me go ahead and first look at Pius XI's critiques of capitalism, which he starts off with. So he kind of lays out three principles for why capitalism, the flaws of capitalism.
Yeah.
Let's see, where is it?
One of his things he's saying is that he's one of the ways he refers to it is this present economic system, because at this time, even though communism and socialism had gained massive foothold, capitalism was still overwhelmingly the economic system of the world. Because he says that in paragraph, right here, paragraph 103. But with the diffusion of modern industry throughout the whole world, the, quote, capitalist economic regime has spread everywhere to such a degree, particularly since the publication of Leo XIII's encyclical, that has invaded and pervaded the economic and social life of even those outside its orbit, and is unquestionably impressing on its advantages, disadvantages, and vices, and in a sense, is giving its own shape and form.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why it's capitalism is sort of the focal point of his criticism, just because of how prominent it is
right
around the world, and especially in the West, I would think.
Yeah, definitely. And so in paragraph 105, he says the first... in the first place, it is obvious that not only is wealth concentrated in our times, but an immense power and despotic economic dictatorship is consolidated in the hands of a few, who often are not owners, but only the trustees and managing directors of invested funds, which they administer according to their own arbitrary will and pleasure. So that's kind of like the first step. And from there, that leads to three kinds of conflict.
Which is in paragraph 107.
And 108 as well.
108 as well.
Yeah. So the first is the struggle for economic supremacy. So between individuals who are vying for economic power and gain in a country. Yeah, and corporations, like definitely, like seeking monopolies over each other, mm-hmm. At this time at least. I guess it kind of...
To some, like you could argue, this time, for example, you know, different social media platforms, like which one is the preferred, but mm-hmm. it's probably not exactly the same, but
yeah. And then he continues, then there's the bitter fight to gain supremacy over the state in order to use an economic struggle to its resources and authority. We kind of see like the fact that, you know, lobbyists potentially could be used for this, whereas there's huge amounts of money being pumped into Congress from different industries in order to keep laws favorable to their own economic enterprises.
Right. Or which, you know, this one group wants most of the economic resources to be put into, say, welfare, whereas the other one wants more money going towards military spending, for example. Mm-hmm. Like, which group gets to determine where these economic resources go?
Mm-hmm. Finally, there is conflict between states themselves, not only because countries employ their power and shape their policies to promote every economic advantage of their citizens, but also because they seek to decide political controversies that arise among nations through the use of their economic supremacy and strength. So yeah, like even nations themselves struggle in order to find, you know, free markets and resources in order to promote their own economic advantages.
And I think that last one was very prevalent during Leo's time, because shortly before that, you had witnessed, you know, the scramble for Africa,
mm-hmm.
and these, you know, the continued expansion of these European colonial empires, which, you know, you could definitely argue there were some advantages that they brought, but there were a lot of disadvantages, and a lot of their motivations were rooted in economic interests, I would think.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And then paragraph 109, he continues, this is a pretty intense paragraph, I'd say. The ultimate consequences of the individualistic spirit in economic life are those which you yourselves, venerable brethren and beloved children, see and deplore. Free competition has destroyed itself. Economic dictatorship has supplanted the free market. Unbridled ambition for power has likewise succeeded greed for gain. All economic life has become tragically hard, inexorable, and cruel. To these are to be added the grave evils that have resulted from an intermingling and shameful confusion of the functions and duties of public authority with those of the economic sphere, such as, one of the worst, the virtual degradation of the majesty of the state, which although it ought to sit on high like a queen and supreme arbitress, free from all partiality and intent upon the one common good and justice, is become a slave, surrendered and delivered to the passions and greed of men.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't I go ahead and break that down? Yeah.
So I think the first thing you could point to is he says economic dictatorship has supplanted the free market.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty important, because what that sense is saying is that Catholic social teaching does not necessarily oppose a genuine free market system, but mm-hmm. for it to function, there have to be certain guidelines, regulations put into place.
Yeah, and he kind of goes into, like, I think later, kind of what those elements of economic dictatorship are. Because he never actually explicitly says what's involved with that. But I think you can kind of extrapolate from later paragraphs what he means by that.
Yeah.
And one of which I think is kind of the expansion of markets into areas that Catholics would consider very immoral and evil.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, pornography and prostitution. We can think like OnlyFans, for instance, right?
Yeah,
like
like someone who's incredibly pro free market might argue, well, that's good because that means then they're providing a genuine market for it. Whereas, well, Yes, but there's a very grave moral issue at stake there.
Right, exactly. And then another thing as well is the fact that the confusing of the political and economic spheres removes the majesty of the state, kind of as being that arbitress of justice and peace, which is supposed to be. I think a lot of people who kind of support like open markets and like laissez-faire capitalism, for instance, they don't recognize the authority of the state to come in and order these operations for the common good.
Yeah, like the state is the ultimate boogeyman. It's the always the common enemy that is opposing their what they perceive to be economic freedoms.
Right. And I remember, well, because kind of like, not kind of like, so an interesting story. So the other day, my family and I went to go see a movie called The 12 Orphans, which is about a baseball movie held in the Great Depression. And it essentially talks about how like a lot of these kids in these orphanages were essentially put to like work, trying to like make money for this orphanage. And I was talking to my parents afterwards, like, it's good that we have like these child labor
Labor
laws in
laws.
place to like stop these cruelties from happening. But someone who supports like no government
No.
intervention whatsoever, they wouldn't support the like, child labor laws, for instance.
Right.
And like that's an example of the state coming in and setting up laws and if any, like restricting the market in order to provide, justice for the common good,
Well, I
right?
think, and that's sort of a another sort of, I think, detour related to that. I remember seeing on Twitter recently there was a the Libertarian Party account of, I think it was Georgia had tweeted something about like we should, they didn't exactly say no child labor laws, but it was pretty close to that they're by having them in, you have these regulations in place that if you were to remove them would bring about like certain at greater economic freedoms and efficiencies, where it's, well,
Yeah,
potentially, but also you're
but
putting
that's
kids to
also
work.
very that can be very unjust
Yeah.
for instance. And that's kind of I think what Pope Pius XI is getting at here. Kind of that removal of authority to the state and kind of giving it to the more the economic sphere as well,
Yeah.
where suddenly it's like the idea like the economic principles are just like supposed to govern themselves, whereas
Yeah.
no, that's the role of the state, not the economy.
Right, because like towards the end of 109, he says that as to international relations, two different streams have issued from the one fountainhead. On the one hand, economic nationalism or even economic imperialism. On the other, a no less deadly and accursed internationalism of finance or international imperialism, whose country is where profit is. So it's this sort of this fear that by allowing an unrestricted market, that will end up becoming sort of the main focal point for all interactions with countries where it's, economic interest trumps everything else.
Definitely. And then he moves on to paragraph 110 and he says, we already kind of addressed all these problems. That's kind of what we've been talking about, capital and labor, how you make that relationship beneficial to the common good and not so antagonistic. The infusion of Christian social philosophy, avoiding individualism and collectivism when it comes to these questions of, property. So we've already talked about most of these issues. I mean, he's addressed them. He's just simply more, talking about it again as a reminder. And then he talks about commutative justice as well, which is, I think, Gio, you have a good way of explaining
Oh,
it.
yeah, sure. So in Catholic teaching, and this kind of goes back to Aquinas, who sort of adopted it from Aristotle, but transfer Christian theology into that teaching, and then is further added upon by various encyclicals and theologians. There's different species of justice within the Catholic tradition. So, like for example, it says here, commutative justice. That's the type of justice of the relationship between various individuals, and that's related to economic exchanges or contractual obligations. And that would be different from, say, distributive justice, where that's the relationship of individuals to the greater society or the state with the same intentions in mind, like how are goods properly distributed, what is considered economic justice from that standpoint.
Definitely. And I think so he and I'm going to just quote that line where he uses commutative justice. Relations of one to the other must be made to conform to the laws of strictest justice. Commutative justice, as it is called, with the support, however, of Christian charity. We talked about that in the last episode, where instead of in order to avoid individualism and collectivism, you need community of justice, but also Christian charity. And then another really interesting line that he, just to finish up paragraph 110, free competition kept within definite and due limits and still more economic dictatorship must be effectively brought under public authority in these matters which pertain to the latter's function. The public institution themselves of peoples, moreover, ought to make all human society conform to the needs of the common good, that is, to the norm of social justice. And kind of just, I was reading this and I thought to myself, this is really, I'm not going to say insidious, but a really wrong mentality that a lot of conservatives have is the idea of neutral institutions. Mm-hmm. Whereas I remember like a recent incident where a football player, you know, came out as, you know, as gay, and he was the first active NFL player, and a bunch of conservatives were arguing for the fact that, you know, football, why can't football just be football? Why do we need to care about these issues?
Yeah.
You know, and the thing is, a lot of them, they don't understand football is not just football. Football is a public institution that as such can really influence how the culture and society perceive certain issues. There's no such thing as a neutral institution.
Right. It's the same thing with conservative relationships to corporations. I mean, they're all about, you know, arguing that there's benefits to big business, we shouldn't regulate them, which to some extent there are some benefits, but look what happens in June. What happens to all of the logos of the major corporations, you know? Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's pretty self-explanatory, and it's, you know, that doesn't come with its without consequences.
Right. And so then Pope Pius XI says that we need to use these public institutions to make human society conform to the common good. And I'm remembering Amazon, for instance, we were talking about this banning conservative books. A friend of mine didn't see a problem with this because they're their own private business and they have the right to police what kind of content they sell on their platform. But the problem with that is the fact that it's the viewpoint that companies have no obligation to kind of like the common good whatsoever. Right, it's just
profit.
Right?
To them, the only purpose a business has is profit, right, which is not true.
Yeah, and there's other secondary consequences of that, which, you know, the institutions, they can, you know, once again, they heavily influence the way we think about certain topics.
Yeah.
Kind of just a brief, that was just a brief aside.
No, there. And I think it's an excellent point. I think I've already mentioned this before, but go, the interview that Matt Frad had with Jacob Imam goes into the topic of Amazon and how, because like one thing, actually in the episode, Jacob Imam gets Matt Frad to cancel his Amazon Prime account, mm-hmm, because he makes the argument that because of some of Amazon's business practices that are antithetical to Catholic teaching, you shouldn't be supporting. And there are exceptions he makes to it. Like, you know, he talks about, for example, buying books on Amazon. Like, there's different caveats to that. But the point is still the same, that a business does have an obligation to the wider community and to contribute, mm-hmm, to that good. It's not just its own entity with the sole focus of making profit.
Right, exactly. Okay, and so then Pius XI switches to socialism. And so this is where he breaks socialism into two different parties. So the first party is communism, and the second party is socialism.
Right.
And so the way he defines communism is that it teaches and seeks two objectives, and this is paragraph 112, unrelenting class warfare and absolute extermination of private ownership. And he keeps going, so not secretly or by hidden methods does it do this, but publicly, openly, and by employing every and all means, even the most violent.
Yeah, so that's pretty self-explanatory. Like, that's, you know, what you would see, I think, during this time with the USSR, for example. You had, mm-hmm, the Bolshevik Revolution, and you saw that system being played out. And I think that's part of the source of this criticism, because you, mm-hmm, just see, like, there's the Holodomor, which occurred in Russia, where you just saw the systematic starvation and massacre of various peoples within the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Millions of people died. Yeah. And so that's how he defines communism. And then he goes into socialism, which he teaches is more moderate. So he teaches that, in this paragraph 113, it not only professes the rejection of violence, but modifies and tempers to some degree, if it does not reject entirely, the class struggle and the abolition of private ownership. And so then he has an interesting statement towards the end of this paragraph where he says that socialism inclines toward and in a certain measure approaches the truths which Christian tradition has always held sacred. For it cannot be denied that its demands at times come very near those that Christian reformers of society justly insist upon. So rights of the workers, for instance. Yeah.
And I think this is important as well, because there's a later on, there's a quote in this document that some conservatives have tried to use to argue that any type, because the quote in here is that he says you cannot be a good Catholic and be a true socialist. But they ignore the wider context, because they try to argue from that line that, oh, haha, you can't support any type of government intervention in the economy and be a good Catholic. Yeah. Whereas you have to look at the greater context. Like, even Trent Horn, who's one of the most overtly pro-capitalist Catholics out there, he's said that the type of capitalist system he supports is similar to that of the Nordic states, which is something that people like Bernie Sanders have supported. Mm-hmm. So it's not without, there's obviously a line that has to be drawn.
And I think the important thing to bring up here is that when Pope Pius XI condemns socialism later, it's because of their concept of society, which is inherently materialistic and atheistic.
Yeah.
And so that's why he condemns socialism, not because they are supporting the worker or supporting unions or stuff like that, but because they have an antithetical conception of society compared to the Catholic tradition.
Yeah, because one of the issues that comes up is, you know, it's the question of, well, what if socialism just rejects these key principles that it adheres to that are contrary to Catholic teaching? Like, what would happen to that? Like, would it be fine then? It's like, well, yes, but at that point you would cease to be socialism. Mm-hmm. So there's really no point, really.
Right.
And this is good as well, because I think that there are certain Catholic groups that who go very dangerously close to accepting these doctrines. Like, there's one group called Tradiste, which is a very traditional Catholic group, but they're very left-wing on a lot of economic issues, and they use
liberation theology.
Yeah, right. And so they use words like socialism, I think, rather irresponsibly, and it's to the point where they use the term, but I don't think they really have a good grasp of what it means.
Right. And well, because Leo XIII and Pius XI talk about hierarchy is not bad, like in an economic system. Like,
yeah.
Like, that is a common thing to have, because different people have different skills and abilities.
Right.
And they can employ those skills and abilities in different ways. I mean, he talks about later around paragraph 130, which we'll get to eventually, the idea that just someone earning profit is not bad, provided they do it in a just and fair way, because they are benefiting, they're helping society. But through their businesses, they're helping people get jobs and work and obtain a wage to support their families. It's not bad to obtain some sort of monetary compensation for doing these good things.
Right.
I think that's kind of the important part as well. A lot of the times I would say we need a holistic approach to a lot of these issues, right? We can't simply approach from the perspective of the economy or just on social, moral issues.
Yeah. You have to take into account everything.
And when you start to overemphasize certain things to the exclusion of others, that's where you run into problems. When you emphasize the economic over the social, you run into problems, and vice versa.
Yeah, like I've experienced this when I was taught about Rerum Novarum originally. The teacher I had really emphasized stuff like this quote from 114, where he says, "For certain kinds of property, it is rightly contended, ought to be reserved to the state, since they carry with them a dominating power so great that cannot without danger the general welfare be entrusted to private individuals." So they'll trumpet that stuff frequently, but they'll ignore, and I also not just Rerum Novarum, but Quadragesima Anno too, where they will overemphasize that aspect of the teaching, but then completely leave out stuff about, you know, right to private property ownership and, you know, the right of businesses to earn wealth. Money. And then vice versa.
And the goods that good businesses provide as well. Mm-hmm. They're not a necessary evil. They are, or they can be good, provided they follow certain moral principles. When they don't do that, then that's where you get into problems.
Yeah, the same thing with
that's working. Not a controversial opinion, or it should not be a controversial opinion to have.
Right. And it's similar to the concept of work too. That is not inherently evil. There is a dignity and sense of fulfillment that comes through that as well. Of course, with the right conditions in place.
Definitely.
And so I think here, according
to... All right, let's see. Let's read paragraph 118, because I think it's good and it's nice and short. For according to Christian teaching, man endowed with a social nature is placed on this earth so that by leading a life in society and under authority and under an authority ordained by God, he may fully cultivate and develop all his faculties under the praise and glory of his Creator, and that by faithfully fulfilling the duties of his craft or other calling, he may obtain for himself temporal and at the same time eternal happiness. Socialism, on the other hand, wholly ignoring and indifferent to the sublime end of both man and society, affirm that human association has been instituted for the sake of material advantage alone. So I think that's his major bone to pick with socialism, is that statement right there.
Yeah.
You can fix the other two of removing private property. You can alleviate that by modifying it, making it not as intense. And class warfare, which you can make that class cooperation. But provided that you have this viewpoint that human association has been instituted for the sake of material advantage alone, that's a flawed opinion and you cannot hold that viewpoint.
Absolutely. The book I'm reading right now by Scott Hahn called It Is Right and Just, he addresses this phenomenon because he says that, because as Pius XI pointed out, that socialism comes from these liberal doctrines of the Enlightenment. And as Scott Hahn points out, that liberalism is inherently secular. And so because of that, any society you have that is based in these doctrines will inevitably, you know, privatize religion or will make it or try to make it irrelevant.
Mm-hmm,
and definitely. So if you want to have a just Catholic society, you cannot have a philosophy that only focuses on material ends.
Mm-hmm. And he actually, Pius XI has a really good quote. I'm very sure this with you, and this reminded me. So it's in paragraph 122. It belongs to our pastoral office to warn these persons of the grave and imminent evil. Let all remember that liberalism is the father of the socialism that is pervading morality and culture, and that Bolshevism will be its heir.
Yeah, it's all connected. Mm-hmm. That's the thing you have to remember. These aren't just separate events that are occurring that have their own mysterious origins. It's all one long strand.
Right, exactly. And ideas have consequences that could be lived out centuries after they first originate. And I think we're really kind of living in that society when a lot of these liberal ideas from the Enlightenment, not just liberal as in like American liberal,
right,
but Enlightenment thinkers are kind of coming to a head right now. Yeah. I think we're seeing the natural fulfillment of a lot of these ideas.
Yeah, and you'll see this in the 1930s as well. You have the emergence of communism, socialism on one hand, then you also have fascism and Nazism on the other. You also have, you know, the imperialism, for example, of the Japanese. Like, it's these, and obviously it's a different circumstance, but you do see the emergence of all these political philosophies that, even though they're very different, they have one thing in common, and that is they are diametrically opposed to the foundational teachings of the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. All right, so let's keep going. So that's up. Now we're up to, okay, so this is kind of, so once he condemns communism and socialism, which he did throughout these few paragraphs, he once again switches to capitalism again, right? Yeah. Kind of, so he talks about it again, or he talks about the right of the state almost. So
right.
He talks about, this is where he gets into economic dictatorship. So paragraph 132, really long, I'm not going to read it. I think the really important thing to keep in mind is the last sentence here. We must not omit to mention those crafty men who wholly unconcerned about any honest usefulness of their work, do not scruple to stimulate the baser human desires, and when they are aroused, use them for their own profit.
Yeah, and I think we see that through a whole host of different avenues today, not just with, you know, pornography or prostitution. We also see that through the tobacco industry and through products like, you know, vape pens or something like that, which, you know, there's some debate you can have about, but the point is the same. Is that when you, like, because he says earlier in 132 that as you expand the market, more and more people show up, which means then that if you're someone's looking to profit from that, you're going to need to find something that people want. And if you realize that, well, if I can access these aspects of the human spirit that are depraved essentially and profit from that you'll find that niche in the market, but the result of that is that creates moral decline across the board.
Right, and I think there definitely is some argument to be made that you can't ban every immoral market. Like, you know, some could argue that alcohol, remember, like prohibition.
Right.
But then there are also things that you simply cannot, like there's some that are just simply like no brainers almost, right? And I believe Thomas Aquinas talks about this. Where you can't ban vice is where it will have a detrimental impact on the common good. So the example he uses is prostitution. And the thing that everyone gets, I'm not going to say, a lot of people don't understand is this is an example for him. If there is a way to ban prostitution and have it not impact the common good, Thomas Aquinas would support it.
Oh,
his argument is the fact that banning prostitution would have a detrimental impact upon the common good. And he gives his own reasons why. But basically, that's kind of the argument. You can't ban vices if the banning of that vice will cause more evil than allowing that vice to exist. So prohibition, for instance, you ban alcohol. Okay, but now you have a huge influx of gang violence. Unfair, yeah, violence. And all these, and they break way more laws than simply just allowing the vice of alcohol to exist. But there are lots of other things like pornography, which has such a detrimental impact upon the human person. There's a really good soul called, I believe it's called The New Drug. It's a website which goes into a lot of scientific articles about how bad pornography is for the individual. I mean, it's so proliferant, like it's everywhere.
Yeah.
That, like, this is an example of, I think, a vice that you can't justify being legal, for instance, in society.
Well, the thing with alcohol as well, which is why, at least in the American context, why banning that is so different from, say, banning marijuana, is that, like, alcohol has been present in American society since the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas something like, you know, an e-cigarette is incredibly new. Like, it's not as ingrained into, you know, the community. So, like, banning one thing would be much easier than the other.
Well, and is smoking a vice? And that this is kind of getting to, like,
right.
I say no.
Yeah, like cigarettes, that one I think is more of
I think personal. Like, there's a social nature that has to be involved with it. I don't think like smoking by yourself in your room is good. I think, but like the social aspect, like drinking by yourself, I say is not good.
Right, or drinking with the purpose to get drunk, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
Or like, you know, smoking marijuana with the intentional purpose of getting high. Like that one, you know, that one is more.
There's a lot of gray area here.
Yeah, but.
I mean, we can talk about this
another time. I think it'd be an interesting topic.
It would be an interesting topic because, like, I come from the position that, do you ever smoke marijuana not to get high, right? And that's kind of.
Yeah, like that's, or like, and really, I think any drug, but a lot of like the drugs that come after that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was talking to some people about this, and some people are arguing that you can actually smoke marijuana and not get high from it.
Really?
Which I think there's a lot of great, and we're kind of getting a bit sidetracked here, but there's a lot of, and then once here's, you can kind of see like why I think another reason why maybe Pius XI isn't laying down policies that states need to follow, because you need to really conform to the culture, and each nation understands its culture, or at least it should understand its culture, and they know what can do.
Yeah, like there's no dogmatically defined statement when it comes to these policy issues from Catholic teaching.
Yeah, which is why this is a guideline.
Like the economy, like obviously there's stuff that's repeatedly condemned, but if you're looking at specific policy, you could have many different things and still technically be in line with the Catholic Church
because
it's such a gray area.
Yeah, and honestly, like you mentioned that Trent Horn supported the Nordic system of capitalism in America. I don't think that will work in the American system, because the benefits that the Nordic countries have is they tend to have much smaller populations. They don't have a large military, and that's kind of where we need to step in to, you know, combat, you know, China and Russia. And kind of like, I know like a lot of people may tend to be more isolationist, but I do think America needs to assume that role in order to combat Russia and China.
Like China is, like I say, with those, like, you know, China's far different from, say, Afghanistan,
right? Exactly. Yeah,
the threat levels there are
very different. Yeah, and so that's kind of like where the Nordic countries, who don't need a super large military, they can, all that money that's no longer going to the military, they can go into these programs which help society. I don't think that the Nordic system of capitalism will really be beneficial to America. Not saying that there shouldn't,
it's bad, but it just from a practical standpoint.
But there could be an American style of capitalism, which is in conformity to Christian virtues, which I think I don't think we're there yet, but I definitely do think it's possible.
Right.
And it's not going to, it may not look anything like the Nordic system, you know? And that's just kind of like each culture and each nation kind of has their own laws and policies which they need to follow in conformity to these moral guidelines that Pius XI is laying down.
Absolutely. Well, because what he says here in the next one is that strict and watchful moral restraint enforced vigorously by governmental authority could have banished these enormous evils and even forestalled them. This restraint, however, has too often been sadly lacking. Which, you know, I think that right there is a complete refutation of any notion from, you know, certain Catholic politicians that, well, personally, I'm a Catholic on all these issues, but, you know, publicly, I wouldn't want to impose my religion on others. It's, you know, and I know it's repetitive at this point, but you cannot say it enough because an American, especially among American Catholics, unfortunately, but really along or really among Americans in general, there's this pervasive attitude that religion is just it's just you do you, but
It's the private sphere. It
it
should
can't
not
leave the
inform. It
house.
can't leave the house. Yeah, exactly. Okay, let's keep going. Let's see. Kind of talks again about the evils of abandoning Christianity. And then we get into paragraph 136, which I love this line. No genuine cure can be furnished for this lamentable ruin of souls, which, so long as it continues, will frustrate all efforts to regenerate society, unless men return openly and sincerely to the teaching of the gospel, to the precepts of Him alone who has the words of everlasting life, words which will never pass away, even if heaven and earth will pass away. So once again, like all these efforts and desires by Republicans and Democrats, libertarians and anarchists or whatever, to regenerate society, unless they're rooted in the gospel, are going to end in failure.
Exactly. And this is the, I think, the major point of the last part of the encyclical is that for any of this to work, and for if we have any hope of society getting better, is it that you need a renewal of what he calls the renewal of Christian spirit. A lot of that comes through education, because what he talks about is that there were individuals who professed themselves to be Catholic, but who then used that, they had a perverted version of the faith and used that to deny, for example, workers' rights or to abuse children. And so, because of that, these people who are often young and very impressionable looked to, say, the socialists and saw them as allies and then left of the church because of that. And so, while we obviously, as Pius says, that we have to recognize that really wasn't entirely their fault, there still needs to be an effort made to bring them back into the
And
church.
that kind of ends like the last few paragraphs, where he argues that what bishops and other higher members of the church should do. I'm looking at paragraph 142. I skipped a little bit just because I think he kind of, repeats himself, the need for the Christian spirit to go out into society. But also paragraph 142, it is chiefly your duty, venerable brethren, and of your clergy to search diligently for these lay apostles, both of workers and of employers, to select them with prudence and to train them and instruct them properly. So kind of that the going out into society and reforming influential members of both the workers and the employers in order to reach the goals he sees that he lays out in Quadragesima Anno.
Yeah, like it has to be an active faith. It's not something that you retain within yourself or with just in your family or your own circle of people. You have to go out and actually spread it. I think one thing I would like to maybe briefly talk about is the point near the end where he mentions women and children in the workforce. Because I think that's a there's this interesting point he makes, because obviously there is this notion that, well, the Catholic Church and others opposed, say, women in the workforce because they thought they were, you know, inferior to men or that they couldn't do the work. And I guess with children, it's obviously very different. But one of the things he talks about in 135 is that part of the reason that they wanted them out of the workforce is because in a society where not only was it mostly dominated by men, but because you had no regulations of these factors in workforce, abuse was very common because there was they could simply get away with it. And so, you know, the idea of saying that the children should not be working and that the women should stay home and rearing them, it wasn't just motivated by some, you know, prejudiced or patriarchal view of the sexes. it was done because they were like, we know that these people are getting are being treated incredibly horribly mm-hmm. by these bosses and by other workers who are not being restrained, and so we need to get them out of there.
Yeah, and their souls are in danger. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I'd read this a while ago, I forgot about that point, so it was just interesting seeing the logic they use for it. Like, it's one you don't really consider, and then you read and you're like, oh, that actually makes so much sense.
Oh, I love this line. Sorry, from paragraph 135. And thus, bodily labor, which divine providence decreed to be performed even after original sin, for the good at once of man's body and soul, is being everywhere changed into an instrument of perversion. For dead matter comes forth from the factory ennobled, while men there are corrupted and degraded. That's just a very great image of, like, dead matter entering a factory, leaving as a product, but inside the factory, the men are being corrupted and degraded.
Yeah,
I think that's just a great one-liner. Right. And there's, like, this encyclical is full of those one-liners, which it's very well written. It's very enjoyable to read. It just, there's something very intellectually it just satisfies the intellect to read. Like the sentences of Pius XI, just as an aside.
Yeah.
But yes, you're definitely right. When it, you know, comes to the women and children
today, obviously the conditions are far different, so that mm-hmm. may not be as obviously there's
quite a larger concern. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So it's not just, you know, it's not the same circumstances.
And the very last thing he brings up, kind of not out of the blue, but kind of just a bit randomly. He talks about the protection of the family. This is paragraph 144. So we're four paragraphs away from finishing. And he introduces the protection of the family. Mm-hmm. So he quotes, I quote, "Certainly there is the greatest need now of such valiant soldiers of Christ who will work with all their strength to keep the human family safe from the dire ruin into which it will be plunged, were the teachings of the gospel to be flouted, and that order of things permitted to prevail, which tramples underfoot no less the laws of nature than those of God."
Well, it's I mean, very self-explanatory, and we've seen what's happened today with once you even cede so much an inch of ground when it comes to the institution of the family, it's just a long slope.
And this is 1933, I believe, right? What happened at this time to that would, you know, make him write this particular statement? Well, wasn't at this time the Anglican Communion taught that contraception in certain situations in the married life was okay. And at that point, tons of Protestant denominations, the majority of tons of them were not pro contraception.
Wow, established teaching.
Yeah, it was just established teaching. Like, you just were, if you were Protestant, you just were against contraception. That was just the thing. It was just, mm-hmm. it was just the assumed standing. At this point, I believe tons of different Protestant denominations began to support contraception. And so I think that's just like a very minor, like...
But it's so relevant when you realize how, especially today, mm-hmm. as you've seen with a lot of these Protestant groups, you know, whereas the Catholic Church remained firm on has remained firm on these teachings, you've noticed with the Protestant world that hasn't happened. And the ones that have continually accepted false teachings, they've gone in decline. Like, mm-hmm. now this was one problem that C.S. Lewis began to have towards the end of his life with the Church of England, was that you were just seeing acceptance of, or, you know, greater boundaries being crossed.
Mm-hmm, right. And I think what's really interesting is, like, contraception in today's world is so universal and assumed. And the fact he could be talking about divorce as well. I think probably both.
Because no divorce laws at this, or no fault divorce laws. I mean, we're still
pretty uncommon. That's just the thing. Like, if we read the same sentence now, maybe he's talking about, you know, polygamy or whatever, you know, something like completely this is like such a very assumed, accepted thing in the society today, and the fact that he's condemning it with such strong language, it's just really interesting. I guess I thought it was really
I really liked this sentence as well in 144, which says, "Rather, she," meaning the Catholic Church, "knows full well through the experience of many centuries that she is wont to come forth from the most violent storm stronger than ever and adorned with new triumphs." Mm-hmm. I think it's a really interesting thing to keep in mind, is that a lot of people, when they, they hear about some supposedly bad thing that's happened in the Catholic Church, they're like, oh, why is the Catholic Church still around? Or how are you ever going to make it in the modern world? It's like, well, the church has survived numerous assaults on her. We've had intellectual attacks, famines, plagues, wars, persecution, heresies. Like, everything that could potentially be thrown at the Catholic Church has been thrown at the Catholic Church. And yet all of those things eventually ended, whereas the church has remained standing to this day.
Right, definitely. And it's kind of like, that brings a lot of comfort for those who are concerned with Pope Francis, for instance. Like, I think he's an okay pope.
Yeah.
I don't have any big concern, but like, for our listeners who are concerned with like what's happening, just don't really
it's not nearly as bad as it could be. Like, it's not great. The situation's not great.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, there is certainly hope to be found.
And there's an element of just like, oh, like, you're sad, just be happy, kind of like that joke. But like, really, like, don't worry. Like, honestly, like, this is like, what's happening now is like
nothing.
Yeah, like, so, but,
remember when most of the bishops were Arians at one point?
I don't, but I read about it.
Yeah, like, it's you read about these times in the church when you just think, like, you're like, wow, like, yeah, I certainly am concerned now, but I couldn't even imagine being someone, or like when we had like two popes, for example.
Yeah,
like, it's like, you think about it, you're like, it, it's been bad before, but it's gotten better. It's like, not trying to be naively optimistic, but it's just something to keep in mind.
And then I think that's looks like it's it. I want to read the last paragraph just because it's cool. Yeah. That this may happily come to pass to all of you venerable brethren and beloved children who are members of the vast Catholic family entrusted to us, but with the especial affection of our heart to workers and to all others engaged in manual occupations, committed to us more urgently by divine providence, and to Christian employers and managements, with paternal love we impart the apostolic benediction.
Amen.
Amen. All right.
Well, anyway, so that is the conclusion of Quadragesimo Anno. So next week we will not have an episode, unfortunately, but then after that we should have one reviewing the Engelbert Dollfuss book, and then following that we will do the next encyclical on the list, which
Octo something.
Well,
Adviens by Paul the Sixth.
It is by Paul the Sixth. We will read that one, and then we will continue on with and the other thing as well, I asked some of the our Instagram account what they thought about potentially reviewing at some point, maybe Scott Hahn's book, It Is Right and Just. I will wait to hear more responses, but it seemed like it was people were liking the post, so it seemed like there was some support for it. So
I, if we have time, read that.
I know, if we have time at some point in the future, we may do it. So yeah, so that's the plan going forward. Thank you guys for listening.
Bit long of an episode, which we apologize for, but it just really dense, and we skipped not quite a bit, but there's a lot of like paragraphs which obviously I think have like a lot of really
good
things to say, a lot of importance that we just don't have time to cover.
Yeah, so obviously read this document for yourself, because it is an incredibly important aspect of our faith and our heritage. So yeah, this has been the Weekly Papist. We're your hosts, Giovanni Del Piero, Michael Pecca, and we will see you next time.
All right, bye, guys.
Care.
Quius natus et viatus.